Many neurofeedback providers already bring real care to their work. Thoughtful assessment, real-time signal review, artifact control, informed consent, consultation, and outcome monitoring. This article is written to support and celebrate that craft, not to portray the field as careless or uniform. Think of it as a friendly companion for the good practice already underway. Neurofeedback also carries a distinctive and interesting set of ethical questions, and that is part of what makes it such rewarding work. The path from scalp voltage to a clinical or performance claim passes through electrode placement, reference choice, filtering, artifact handling, feature extraction, normative comparison, thresholding, feedback logic, and human interpretation. Each layer can be beautifully done. Each can also add uncertainty, hide an error, or make a weak inference look more persuasive than it is. Noticing those layers is not a criticism of the field. It is simply good stewardship of a powerful tool. This article focuses on the EEG and the QEEG. It does not claim that every ethical issue discussed here is unique to neurofeedback, nor does it cover every form of neurofeedback or neuromodulation. Where law, regulation, licensure, an employer's policy, or a professional code sets a higher or more specific requirement, that requirement governs. I am grateful to Donald Moss, Ronald J. Swatzina, and Franz J. Cronje for conversations that informed my thinking about this rapidly changing area, especially artificial intelligence. I extensively use Dr. Swatzina and Dr. Barbara Peavy's 2026 Biofeedback Society of Texas Ethics presentation. None of my colleagues reviewed or endorsed this article. Any mistakes are exclusively the author's. Central principle: keep the client or trainee, the raw physiology, the full context, and accountable human judgment ahead of the tools that summarize them. Everything else in this article is just a friendly elaboration of that one idea. 1. Start by naming the practice context. Neurofeedback is delivered in several materially different contexts, and our ethical language becomes clearer and kinder when we simply name the context before we make a claim. Doing so protects both the client and the provider. Some safeguards apply in every context: accurate representation of competence, valid recording, attention to artifact and state, understandable consent, data protection, and a plan for unexpected symptoms. Other duties depend on whether the service is clinical, performance-oriented, or research. Some neurofeedback approaches do not use formal QEEG, Z-scores, or normative databases. The sections on maps, database fit, and quantitative reports apply only when those tools are used, while the raw signal, artifact, state, consent, supervision, data, and outcome safeguards apply more broadly. 2. Use evidence labels, not a single rhetorical volume. The recommendations below are deliberately labeled. The goal is honesty and humility. An author's preference should never quietly dress itself up as settled consensus. Labeling keeps the conversation open and respectful of the reader's own judgment. 3. Seven core safeguards. 7 safeguards form the backbone of this framework, and they work best together rather than in isolation. The first is to build raw signal competence and to know where to find qualified review. Anyone who acquires or trains from EEG can learn to verify recording quality, recognize common artifacts and vigilance changes, and sense when a record deserves a more qualified look, a matter of professional guidance joined to evidence-informed risk management. The second is to let EEG and QEEG inform rather than stand alone whenever a mental or neurodevelopmental question is on the table, since they are wonderful contributors to a picture rather than a solo diagnostic test, a point grounded in professional guidance and biomarker evidence. The third is to treat candidate biomarkers as good questions rather than verdicts, because a correlation is an invitation to look closer rather than a diagnosis, cause, prognosis, or automatic training target. An instance of evidence-informed risk management. The fourth safeguard is to stay curious about competing explanations before interpreting a pattern, because artifact, drowsiness, sleep loss, medication, substances, pain, illness, a past head injury, an environmental exposure, time of day, and recording conditions can all shift the signal. Curiosity here is a genuine gift to the client, and it rests on professional guidance and technical evidence. The fifth is to keep QEEG in a supportive relationship with the raw EEG and the full formulation, so that no map, Z-score, classifier, or normative report has to carry decisive weight by itself. Again, reflecting professional guidance and evidence-informed risk management. The sixth is to keep accountable clinical authority with qualified people. Software may assist within transparent bounds, yet it does not need to silently determine candidacy, diagnosis, treatment target, protocol, or stopping decisions, a stance consistent with broad health AI guidance. And the seventh is to design supervision and staffing around continuous observation and prompt help. I recommend one responsible trainer per independent treatment unit as a conservative starting point, unless an alternative model can demonstrate equivalent safety and accountability, which I offer as an author-proposed conservative clinic policy. 4. Raw EEG competence comes first, and it can be a team sport. Competence with the raw EEG is not the same as being a clinical electroencephalographer, and no one needs to carry every level of expertise alone. A fair and encouraging standard simply distinguishes three levels of responsibility and invites collaboration across them. A provider does not have to perform every level personally. A documented team arrangement with timely access to qualified review meets the safety need beautifully. The one gentle caution: a map or automated report is best not relied upon when nobody involved can yet evaluate whether the underlying recording is physiologically plausible. Current technical guidance for clinical QEEG emphasizes standardized acquisition, visual inspection, artifact management, data selection, and transparent processing. Routine diagnostic EEG standards offer useful technical context, though they were written for clinical neurophysiology rather than outpatient neurofeedback. AAPB and ISNR likewise value competence with the device, physiology, scope, and relevant supervision. A practical, achievable baseline brings several of these skills together. It means being able to verify the montage, reference, sampling rate, filters, impedances or contact quality, calibration where applicable, and channel integrity, and to inspect unprocessed or minimally processed data and review it in alternate montages when the system permits. It also means recognizing and, when safe, reproducing common artifacts, distinguishing alert wakefulness from drowsiness and sleep onset, and flagging persistent suspicious activity without assigning a diagnosis outside one's scope. Just as importantly, it means documenting uncertainty, inviting consultation, and deferring interpretation or training when validity or significance is still an open question. Practice rule: if the raw record is unavailable, inadequate, or not competently reviewed, the quantitative output is best not given decisive clinical weight. This protects the client and takes pressure off the provider. 5. Knowing when to consult or refer is a strength, not a shortcoming. Referral is never a sign that neurofeedback failed. It is one of the most caring things a provider can offer because it protects clients from scope errors and delayed care and often opens the door to the real, treatable driver of their symptoms. The right action depends on urgency, the provider's own license and competence, and local procedures. A psychiatrist, psychologist, physician, counselor, or other licensed provider may be able to assess and manage a concern directly. Another provider may consult or refer. One of the most helpful mindsets a neurofeedback provider can hold is curiosity about the underlying cause of a presentation. Symptoms that look like anxiety, depression, ADHD, or even psychosis can sometimes arise from substance use, medication effects, a medical condition, a past head injury, or an environmental exposure. Colleagues such as Swatsina and Peavy have made this point vividly for the whole mental health field. Presenting signs and symptoms do not always reveal what is actually happening underneath. For a neurofeedback provider, this is genuinely good news. It means a thoughtful referral can sometimes unlock relief that no training protocol would have reached on its own. A friendly set of look a little closer flags. Several signals gently suggest that a physiological or environmental contributor may be worth exploring alongside the neurofeedback work. None is alarming on its own. Each is simply a prompt to stay curious and, where appropriate, to loop in a medical or specialist colleague. An atypical presentation, symptoms that do not fit familiar patterns or carry unusual features, is one such nudge, as is a limited response that shows little movement despite appropriate, well-delivered, evidence-based care. Concurrent physical symptoms, such as unexplained physical complaints or abnormal examination findings alongside the psychological picture, invite the same gentle curiosity, and so does an abrupt onset in which severe symptoms emerge suddenly without a clear psychological precipitant. Perhaps the most telling prompt of all is an environmental correlation, where symptoms rise and fall with a change of setting or exposure. For example, easing when the person is away from home. A few findings are best not treated as standalone referral triggers. Some observations are simply too nonspecific to send someone along on their own. A supposed normal pressure hydrocephalus pattern, inferred from generalized slowing, does not qualify, nor does low posterior dominant rhythm amplitude or frequency offered as a test of cerebral perfusion. A PHQ-9 or other questionnaire cutoff is not a referral trigger without clinical assessment and risk inquiry. And neither is a software-generated diagnosis or arrhythmia label drawn from a non-diagnostic signal. Generalized slowing and posterior rhythm changes are non-specific. 6. EEG and QEEG shine as contributors, not standalone diagnostic tests. A raw EEG can reveal findings that meaningfully change a medical differential, which is genuinely valuable. That is a different thing from diagnosing ADHD, depression, anxiety, PTSD, autism, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, or a personality disorder. A QEEG can summarize spectral power, asymmetry, connectivity, phase, source estimates, or database deviations. These metrics are useful for research, measurement, hypothesis generation, and clinical correlation. What they cannot do on their own is establish or exclude a mental or neurodevelopmental diagnosis. The heart of the matter is the gap between group-level association and individual-level decision-making. A feature may differ on average between research samples, yet lack the sensitivity, specificity, predictive value, stability, transportability, or incremental validity needed for diagnosis in a particular person. Similar features can appear across diagnoses in healthy participants and under fatigue, drowsiness, medication, pain, or artifact. This is also where the underlying cause mindset pays off. The same presentation can be shaped by contributors that live outside the EEG entirely. Substance use and the medications used to treat it, prescribed psychiatric medications, a mild traumatic brain injury, a structural finding such as an arachnoid cyst or Chiari malformation, an endocrine or metabolic condition, a nutritional factor, sleep loss, or an environmental exposure. Widely used diagnostic frameworks already ask clinicians to consider substance, medical, and environmental factors before assigning a mental health diagnosis. So a neurofeedback provider who keeps these possibilities in view is simply practicing in good company. AAPB states that biofeedback is an adjunct and cannot be used alone to make a diagnosis. A responsible diagnostic formulation therefore rests on symptoms, duration, impairment, developmental and medical history, sleep and substance factors, validated measures, differential diagnosis, and the qualified clinician's scope, and would still stand even if the EEG were removed from the chart. 7. Treat biomarkers as questions, not verdicts. The word biomarker can sound more authoritative than the evidence warrants. A measurable feature can correlate with a disorder, yet remain unfit for diagnosis, prognosis, treatment selection, or monitoring, and that is completely okay. It just means the finding is a lead to follow, not a conclusion to announce. A clinically useful diagnostic biomarker performs at the individual level in the intended population under realistic conditions, with validated thresholds and known error rates. A treatment selection biomarker shows that using it improves outcomes compared with not using it. Psychiatry still lacks robust, broadly validated biomarkers for most individual diagnoses and treatment decisions. This is a shared frontier, not a personal failing. When a putative EEG biomarker appears, a good next move is to ask a gentle question of it. Faced with excess theta, one might wonder whether the person is drowsy, sleep-deprived, developmentally younger than the database, taking a sedating medication, or producing eye or movement artifact. High beta invites a look for facial, temporalis, neck, or scalp EMG, along with a thought about the timing of anxiety, stimulant use, pain, or reference instability. An asymmetry raises its own set of questions. Does it replicate? Does it persist in alternate montages? And could electrode contact, skull factors, state, or database mismatch explain it? A connectivity or phase deviation is worth interrogating for stability across clean epochs, pre-processing choices, reference methods, and software implementations. In every one of these cases, no single finding needs to become a protocol target on its own. A Z-score is not the probability of a disease. It is a standardized distance from a reference mean under assumptions about the sample, age range, recording conditions, hardware, pre-processing, artifact handling, and distribution. A value outside a statistical interval can be real, yet clinically irrelevant. A value inside the interval can coexist with genuine impairment. Practice rule: let a candidate biomarker sharpen the next step. Replication, history, testing, consultation, or referral, rather than convert correlation into identity. Interpret qEEG alongside the raw EEG and the full context. A qEEG is derived from the raw EEG. It is a companion to it, not an independent test. Quantification can compress data, support reproducible measurement, and surface patterns worth reviewing. It can also hide morphology, timing, state transitions, artifacts, and normal variants that decide whether the numbers mean anything. Keeping the two together is where the craft lives. A defensible and satisfying sequence unfolds in order. It begins by establishing recording quality and verifying settings, then moves to inspecting the raw EEG in appropriate montages and timescales. From there, it identifies the person's vigilance and behavioral state, marks, removes, or models artifact using transparent rules, and confirms that enough representative clean data remain. Only then does it make sense to examine quantitative summaries and database comparisons, and finally to integrate the findings with the full clinical or performance formulation. Reversing this order can quietly invite confirmation bias. A dramatic map appears first, and the reviewer then searches the record for support while overlooking alternatives. Working in order keeps us honest and relaxed. Keeping the raw data, not only screenshots or a vendor report, is a real kindness to your future self and to the next reviewer. It lets someone determine which epochs entered the analysis, what artifact decisions were made, what reference and pre-processing were used, which database and software version were applied, and whether the result reproduces after correction. Current IQCB technical guidance places strong emphasis on these acquisition, inspection, selection, and processing steps. Vendor opacity is simply a reason to assign a little less weight to an output. A proprietary system is not automatically invalid, but a report is best not allowed to drive consequential decisions when clinically material details, raw traces, epoch selection, artifact handling, database characteristics, processing parameters, or model limitations cannot be examined. CRED Neurofeedback supports transparent reporting of signal processing, regulation success, artifact procedures, adverse effects, and clinically meaningful outcomes in neurofeedback experiments. It is a lovely transparency model, though it is not a clinical practice standard, and is best not cited as if it settled every operational rule in a clinic. Expect artifacts and continuously monitor your client's state. Artifacting is not a one-time housekeeping step finished during pre-processing. It is a friendly rival explanation, worth reconsidering whenever the signal or reward rate changes. Treating it that way is a mark of expertise, not of doubt. Blinks and slow eye movements can inflate low frequencies, especially frontally. Jaw, temporalis, neck, and scalp muscle can elevate faster frequencies. Movement, cable sway, poor contact, bridging, electrode pops, sweat, mains interference, pulse, and reference instability can create spatially convincing, non-cerebral patterns. Drowsiness can shift alpha and theta in ways that resemble a training effect. Watch the client or trainee and the raw signal together. When a reward rate jumps, wonder aloud whether the person closed the eyes, tensed the jaw, shifted posture, spoke, swallowed, touched a lead, held the breath, or became drowsy. Check whether contact quality changed, the reference became noisy, or automated correction began removing a different share of the data. Automated artifact detection is a helpful partner, and it works best when the operator knows what it detects, what it misses, whether it merely withholds feedback or transforms the signal, and how false detections affect learning. Over-aggressive cleaning can remove genuine activity. Permissive cleaning can reward artifact. A little familiarity goes a long way. Pre-recording and pre-session state check. This is also the natural place to stay curious about the wider physiological picture. Many everyday and environmental factors can nudge either the symptoms or the signal, and simply asking about them, warmly, as routine care, often reveals a contributor worth addressing or referring. An EEG samples activity under particular conditions. It is a snapshot, not a fixed portrait of the person. Pharmaco-EEG guidance exists precisely because medications can change vigilance, spectral power, and reactivity. Sleep, pain, illness, stress, exercise, caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, cannabis, time of day, hydration, and food intake can also shift state or artifact burden. A missed meal does not produce one universal EEG pattern. A small 2025 crossover study found no broad behavioral or absolute power impairment after an 18-hour fast while reporting a possible frontal theta change that calls for cautious interpretation. The practical, non-dramatic point is to document last food intake and symptoms, not to conclude that fasting caused theta. 10. Keep assessment and planning matched to the context. Clinical treatment. A clinical neurofeedback assessment is richer and more rewarding than QEEG acquisition plus a software report. The responsible clinician gets to know the client's goals, symptoms, functional impairment, developmental and medical history, sleep, medication and substance use, pain, relevant trauma history, current treatment, preferences, and risk factors. Standardized measures fit the actual treatment target. This is also where a light, curious screen for underlying and contributing causes fits naturally into good care. Without overreaching scope, a clinician can hold open questions about substance use, medication side effects, possible medical or neurological contributors, including past head injuries and structural findings, genetic and metabolic factors, and environmental exposures, and can order or refer for appropriate testing when the picture warrants it. Frameworks that move from simple observation toward more detailed testing and that lean on interdisciplinary collaboration help ensure nothing important is quietly missed. The aim is not to turn a neurofeedback clinic into a medical workup center. It is to stay alert to the person's whole story and to partner generously with medical and environmental colleagues. The evaluation is performed or supervised by someone whose license and competence cover the presenting problem. Neurofeedback, or QEEG certification, does not by itself create authority to diagnose or treat outside a professional scope. A written plan works well when it states the functional target, together with the evidence for the proposed approach in this indication and population, and when it names the reasonable alternatives. It is stronger still when it sets out the expected session range and cost, the outcome measures and a predetermined review point, and the adverse event monitoring and stop rules, along with the referral and coordination contingencies, and where QEEG was used, how it contributed. The protocol makes sense from the client's goals, formulation, evidence, and safety profile, even if the QEEG image were removed from the chart. Performance or educational training. Performance providers do well to define a measurable, non-clinical goal, such as sustained attention during a task, recovery after stress, sleep regularity, or a sport-specific outcome. There is no need to convert ordinary variation into a disorder label or to imply that training treats a condition, unless the service is legitimately clinical and within scope. Safety screening, artifact control, understandable consent, privacy, and referral remain part of the care. When symptoms suggest a medical or diagnosable mental health condition, the provider warmly explains the limits of the service and encourages consultation with an appropriately licensed professional. As ISNR guidance recognizes, research invites a protocol, appropriate ethics review, consent that distinguishes research from care, data governance, adverse event procedures, and transparent reporting. CRED neurofeedback is especially relevant here because it addresses experimental design, control conditions, regulation success, artifact handling, behavioral outcomes, adverse effects, and reporting. A research protocol is best kept from quietly turning into individualized treatment, and clinical services are best not marketed as research to sidestep ordinary professional responsibilities. When the QEEG and the rest of the assessment disagree, there is no need to give the MAP automatic priority. A mismatch may reflect artifact, state, database mismatch, unreliable measurement, an incomplete assessment, or a genuine but non-specific finding. Recheck the raw signal, replicate under matched conditions, broaden the assessment, consult, or gently set the quantitative finding aside. Disagreement is information, not a problem. Let algorithms assist and keep accountable authority with people. Modern neurofeedback runs on algorithms, and that is a good thing. Filters, transforms, artifact gates, thresholds, reward schedules, adaptive difficulty, source estimates, classifiers, and displays are all computational. The ethical question is not whether an algorithm is present. It is simply whether software might silently control a decision for which a human professional remains accountable. A responsible professional understands the rule, watches its effects, can override it, and documents material changes. Keeping the raw EEG and artifact information visible, rather than watching only the reward display, keeps the human in the loop. Recording software, model, and database versions rounds it out. Broad WHO and medical device guidance supports human autonomy, transparency, intended use clarity, disclosure of limitations, and evaluation of the human software team. These documents are not neurofeedback practice standards, and FDA device guidance applies only when a product in use falls within the relevant regulatory framework. They are offered here as general design and governance principles, not as direct authority for a particular protocol or staffing model. Unexpected software behavior is best treated as a quality or safety event. Pause, determine what changed, preserve logs, check whether the delivered intervention still matches the approved plan, and report or escalate as appropriate. There is no need to explain an unexplained system change as the client's brain resisting. 12. Keep technician roles clear, well-supported, and appreciated. AAPB endorses technicians providing clinical biofeedback under the direct supervision of an appropriately trained and licensed clinician. It states that treatment changes are directed by the supervisor and that the supervisor is present at the location where training occurs. ESNR asks providers to disclose the technician's qualifications, role, and degree of supervision. A skilled technician contributes enormously. Electrode application, recording, coaching, documentation, and implementation of an established plan. To protect both the client and the technician, a few decisions are best kept out of the technician's independent hands: diagnosing or formulating a clinical condition, dismissing suspicious activity as benign, or selecting a clinical target, or accepting a software-recommended protocol without review. In the same spirit, a technician is best not asked to independently change sites, frequency targets, or other clinically material parameters outside delegated bounds. To decide that an adverse change is acceptable, or to decide that referral or escalation is unnecessary. The supervising professional reviews the assessment and relevant raw EEG, approves the plan and permitted adjustments, defines escalation criteria, remains available as required by the applicable standard and law, and reviews outcomes and adverse events. A written delegation protocol that names actions permitted independently, actions requiring real-time approval, and actions that are off-limits gives everyone confidence and clarity. 13. Design staffing around observation and response, not a universal slogan. Professional sources support direct supervision, observation, coaching, and accountable changes in treatment. They do not establish a universal one trainer to one client ratio for every neurofeedback setting, and it is fine to say so plainly. For clinical neurofeedback, I recommend assigning one responsible trainer to one independent treatment unit, unless the clinic can demonstrate that another staffing model provides continuous observation, prompt intervention, effective coaching, transparent supervision, and equivalent safety for the actual clients, protocols, and setting. This is a starting point offered in a spirit of care, not a judgment on clinics that have found other safe models. An intentional dyad is an author-proposed category, not an established professional standard. It describes two people participating together because the joint interaction is itself the defined intervention. Both consent, the shared goal is explicit, and the trainer can observe and respond to both. It is not a label for unrelated clients scheduled together for convenience. A clinic using any multi-client arrangement can feel confident when the whole picture holds together. That means the client age, acuity, communication ability, and risk are appropriate for the arrangement, and that the trainer can continuously observe each client along with the relevant raw signal or artifact indicators, and can physically reach and respond to any client promptly. It also means that coaching and therapeutic interaction are not reduced to occasional dashboard checks, that automated changes remain bounded rather than a substitute for review, and that escalation criteria and stop rules are explicit. And it means that the responsible supervisor is present and accountable as required, that clients understand the staffing model and who is responsible for them, and that incidents, near misses, and outcomes are reviewed. The concern with high-throughput arrangements is simply divided attention and delayed intervention, not the mere presence of multiple monitors or rooms. Neutral, observable language keeps the discussion focused on safety rather than motives, which is better for everyone. 14. Let consent explain uncertainty, supervision, and incidental findings. Consent is an opportunity to build trust, not merely a form to complete. Alongside electrode placement and session length, it helps to explain what scalp EEG measures and what qEEG mathematically summarizes, And to be clear that EEG and QEEG are not standalone diagnostic tests for mental or neurodevelopmental disorders. A good consent conversation covers the evidence and uncertainty for the specific indication, protocol, and population, the reasonable alternatives, expected cost and duration, outcome measures, and review points, and the possible adverse experiences the client is warmly welcome to report. It also specifies who will be present, whether a technician is involved, and who may make protocol changes, describes what adaptive or algorithmic features are active and what their limits are, and explains how incidental or suspicious findings will be reviewed and communicated, as well as how data will be stored, shared, processed by vendors, retained, and deleted. Teach back is a gentle way to surface misunderstandings. Invite the client to explain what the QEEG can and cannot tell them, who makes decisions, what symptoms to report, and when continuation will be revisited. A neutral incidental finding statement is often kinder and safer than either reassurance or speculation. This observation is not diagnostic, but it is worth a look from a professional qualified in medical EEG. 15. Keep an auditable record. A good record is a gift to the next qualified professional, letting them reconstruct what was measured, inferred, delivered, and changed. At assessment, document the person's state, sleep, medications and other substances, dose timing, food and fluid intake, caffeine and nicotine, time of day, recording conditions, montage, reference, sampling rate, filters, contact quality or impedances, hardware and software versions, artifact procedures, rejected epochs, and the normative database or model used. Preserve the raw EEG and, when applicable, the relationship between raw epochs and quantitative results. For planning, record the functional target, evidence base, formulation, alternatives considered, reason for the protocol, who approved it, permitted automatic adjustments, stop rules, referral contingencies, and review date. For each session, record signal quality, observed artifacts, client state, parameters actually delivered, algorithmic changes, coaching, adverse experiences, deviations from plan, and consultation. When a technician conducts the session, identify the technician and supervisor. The system adjusted itself is not quite enough on its own. Version and parameter records make it possible to confirm that a later session still delivered the intervention approved at the outset. 16. Protect neural data and choose vendors thoughtfully. The EEG is not a transcript of thought, but it is sensitive physiological data and deserves respect. Under research conditions, EEG features can even support person identification. Raw EEG, QEEG features, questionnaires, medication histories, video, and session metadata can together form a detailed longitudinal profile. It helps to map the actual data flows, minimize collection, separate identifiers where feasible, encrypt storage and transfer, restrict access, set retention and deletion rules, and disclose cloud or vendor processing. The 2026 Systematic Review of EEG Neurofeedback Ethics highlights informed consent, psychological risk, data privacy, vulnerable populations, enhancement, and scientific validity as recurring themes. Vendor contracts and policies are worth reading for ownership, secondary use, breach response, data location, subcontractors, model training, sale or disclosure, deletion, and export in a usable format. Obtaining separate authorization for research, teaching, or product development use, and never making ordinary care contingent on agreeing to unrelated secondary use, keeps trust intact. Planning for vendor failure or discontinuation ensures clients retain access to their records. A system that blocks access to clinically material raw data or reserves broad secondary use rights is best not allowed to determine care by default. 17. use stop rules and outcome checkpoints. Setting reassessment and stopping rules before a course begins is a calm, confidence-building habit. It helps to pause a session whenever the raw signal is invalid, whenever the client becomes drowsy, distressed, medically symptomatic, or unable to participate, or whenever a concerning neurological, cardiac, psychiatric, or physical change appears. The same holds true when software behaves unexpectedly or when the trainer cannot yet explain what is being reinforced or inhibited. Stop or substantially revise a course when harms persist, consent is compromised, a needed referral remains incomplete, costs outweigh likely benefit, the protocol has drifted from its rationale, or meaningful progress is absent at the predetermined checkpoint. Judge outcomes by agreed clinical, functional, educational, or performance measures, not by reward scores or QEEG normalization alone. Ask whether attention, sleep, pain, mood, functioning, or performance improved by a meaningful amount, and whether the change can reasonably be linked to training rather than expectancy, concurrent treatment, maturation, practice effects, or regression to the mean. This is also a natural moment to revisit lifestyle contributors: sleep, nutrition, physical activity, and environment, since gains in those areas can support and sustain the training. CRED neurofeedback encourages attention to regulation success, behavioral significance, adverse effects, and the relationship between brain regulation and clinical outcomes in research. Clinics may happily borrow those transparency habits while remembering that CRED neurofeedback is not a practice mandate. A periodic, friendly practice audit can review raw signal competence, artifact rates, referrals, protocol changes, staffing and response capacity, adverse events, software versions, consent comprehension, data governance, and outcomes. EEG neurofeedback often adds modality-specific signal processing and interpretive layers. That is reason enough to tailor a few safeguards without ever claiming that it is inherently more ethical, more dangerous, or more important than any form of EMG, HRV, respiratory, thermal, or other biofeedback. 18. 7 takeaways. 7 ideas capture the spirit of the whole framework. The first is to match claims and duties to the context, remembering that clinical treatment, performance training, research, and formal QEEG assessment each have their own purpose and are not interchangeable. The second is to build raw signal competence at the right level, since every operator can grow acquisition, artifact, vigilance, and stop rule skills, while qualified clinical or medical review can be shared across a team. The third is to let the map inform the work while staying curious about the underlying cause, because EEG and QEEG enrich an evaluation, even as a mental or neurodevelopmental diagnosis rests on a full, multi-method picture, one that keeps substance, medical, and environmental contributors in view. The fourth idea is to treat biomarkers and Z-scores as prompts for inquiry, replicating, checking state and artifact, consulting, and correlating before using a finding in a plan. The fifth is to keep software and quantitative summaries in supportive relationship with reviewable physiology and accountable people, welcoming automation as an assistant within visible, reversible bounds. The sixth is to choose supervision and staffing models that can show observation, response, and accountability, treating one trainer per independent treatment unit as a conservative author recommendation rather than a universal mandate. And the seventh is to make the practice auditable so that clear consent, role boundaries, referral procedures, data governance, stop rules, functional outcomes, and versioned records turn good intentions into observable, sustainable practice.